Patricia Pearson told Anne Strainchamps why she thinks Americans are so anxious.
I think the reason for that has to do with the higher degree of what you might call militant individualism in the United States compared to certain other cultures. So where you have that sort of high level of isolation, that sense that everything rises and falls on your own shoulders, that you have to have material aspirations, those kinds of things will provoke a much higher level of anxiety than even in countries where there are more fear-making experiences. So for instance, in Mexico, where some of the drug guys are actually sewing their rivals' heads onto soccer balls and other frightening things going on around them, Mexicans have a much lower level of anxiety because they're buffered by certain factors. They're buffered by persistence of rituals that they engage in, by faith, by the constancy of their faith, by the uniformity and tightness of their community. So those kinds of factors will buffer what anxiety you would be having in those cultures.
Is one major buffer lower expectations?
I think so. I mean, that was something I pondered when I was down. I was born in Mexico, so I went down to sort of wonder about whether or not my own levels of anxiety would have been lower if I'd lived there instead of moving up north. When you have relatively low material expectations because you're basically in a situation of widespread poverty, there's less frustration or thwartedness with your station in life. It's tricky. It's a tricky thing to argue because you don't want to sound like you're poor and therefore happy, because mm-hmm. that's not really the issue, but it's more that you have less, you're less self-remonstrative, you're less self-tormenting.
Mm-hmm. So what nations are amongst the least anxious in the world?
Well, oddly enough, China has one of the lowest levels of anxiety. Nigeria has a really low level of anxiety. So this was all done, the World Health Organization did a cross-cultural investigation into levels of anxiety. And they tried to train the investigators to make sure that they were getting the right answers, even though the vocabulary would be different in different countries.
Boy, you know, we think of both of those countries as having some of the worst living conditions in the world. Why would anxiety levels be less? You'd think they'd be higher.
Well, for instance, in China, there's a somewhat different formulation of selfhood. So you're living in a very collective society. Chinese children are brought up to be less self-monitoring of their emotions. Their parents aren't saying to them all the time, how are you feeling? And there's some interesting research on this, actually, comparing Chinese and American children. So they're not actually paying as much attention to their personal angst as opposed to perhaps their sort of collective concerns.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm also thinking about your definition of anxiety as fear in search of a cause. Do you think that Americans simply have too much time to think? We're overthinking our entire lives, and this makes us more prone to anxiety?
I think it's not so much time to think as too many options. There's too many routes you can take. There are too many choices in the supermarket. There are too many jobs you can pursue or hope to pursue in this particular economic climate. There are too many lovers that you can have. There's an overwhelming amount of possibility, and within that freedom, you become very anxious because there's no sense of certainty.
You also write very movingly about your own personal experiences of anxiety. Let's talk some about your own history. What are some of your very earliest memories of experiencing extreme levels of anxiety?
Well, I remember being very anxious as a child, but I didn't recognize it as anxiety because I just had my own frame of reference and I thought everybody was just like me. But I had lived in New Delhi, India during the war that broke out briefly between India and Pakistan. And we were subjected to nightly blackouts because the Pakistani Air Force might bomb Delhi. And that began for me an intense fear of the darkness, a fear that I had to somehow be vigilant and try to control the night and keep my family safe. And then that displaced, because when I moved back to Canada, I actually forgot where the source of that anxiety had come from and just became fearful that there were serial killers outside my house. And I see this with my daughter now. She does the same thing. These levels of fear that embed in you in childhood shift and shape-shift as you get older and you can't remember anymore the origins. And then I think I was pretty much fine for many years. I had a very structured childhood and a very structured adolescence, and I think that helped a lot. I was in boarding school. We had to wear uniforms. There was a lot of ritual. We went to church every Sunday. So it really wasn't actually until I was in college that I had my first full-blown experience of really coming to a halt, where I was basically paralyzed with anxiety.
Can you describe some what happened then during that period in your 20s?
when I was deciding to write about this in my book, it was difficult because I wanted to be able to convey why it would be that having an early love affair collapse on you would be so shattering, given that we've sort of normalized the idea now that love doesn't last and that people have multiple partners and that it's all liberating and fine and to explore and so on. But I think that for me, because my parents had had such a stable relationship, that was a very strong sort of sense for me of my model of the world. And so when I was with someone who turned out to be somewhat sociopathic and unapologetic and unpredictable in sort of vanquishing me from their lives, it completely disturbed my model of the world.
Well, this is a guy, you were deeply in love with him. He behaved as though he was deeply in love with you, and then one day simply announced that he was also deeply in love with somebody else.
Yeah, without apology or... So it's not quite as simple as, you know, somebody just breaking up with you. It was actually the revelation that the person that you thought you were with was not the person that he was. But it's that sense of just having a shattered reality.
How did you recover?
I was at graduate school at the University of Chicago at the time. I withdrew, and I came back and had a very sort of simple existence in my sister's basement for a few months, watching the Olympics on television and learning how to drive. And I just came through it and restored my confidence without actually gaining any insight into what had happened. So it was many years before I understood what had made me vulnerable.
Now, you had a second kind of breakdown years later while you were working as a field producer for a TV show about true crime. Did that breakdown have anything to do with the subject you were immersed in?
Yeah. For several years in New York, I was a crime journalist, and I was completely fascinated by the psychology of criminals and what made a psychopath a psychopath. And I think that in retrospect, it was partly because of this earlier experience of having been with somebody who had sociopathic tendencies. So I needed to understand what made people the way they were in that sense. But I was quite careless of the impact on me. And so I would go to prisons, I would talk to murderers, I would cover very, very difficult trials. And I think there was a cumulative toxic effect. I think this happens actually also to quite often to police officers and certainly to juries, where I wouldn't call it post-traumatic stress disorder because I'm not convinced that that is a viable diagnosis. But it was more almost like a kind of cumulative intoxication of my psyche, so that I became quite suspicious of people around me and began to find it difficult to discern who was good and who was evil. Hmm. And again, that sort of brought me to a bit of a halt.
And again, did you cure yourself?
That time, I think I briefly, for about 2 weeks, went on something called Luvox. But then I discovered I was pregnant with my daughter. And so all of that period of sort of despair and dismay and apprehensiveness resolved into the creation of this new life and became very positive.
By now, we've created a kind of culture in which many people simply to get by need to take antidepressants. You've been there, done that, and decided that you didn't want to live the rest of your life on antidepressants, but found that it was actually quite hard to get off them.
It can be very difficult to get off them. I think many of your listeners will agree with me on that point. It depends on the one, but there's a couple that are particularly difficult to get off of. Really, I've known people who've had to go down to trying to withdraw one granule at a time from these capsules. And often it's just not worth it. I mean, it just becomes so complicated and time-consuming and emotionally difficult that people will put it off because they can still afford, you know, the monthly prescription. There's not quite enough of an incentive to do it, so you'll find that people are on them for 10 years, 15 years. What I decided that was bothersome to me was that I had lost some capacity for joy. And so not only had I lost my sorrow, but I'd also lost my joy, and I wanted it back.
It was a bargain you were not willing to make. The flattening effect wasn't something you wanted to live with.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that there are factors that can buffer us so that, you know, even though I'm wired to be an anxious person, there's ways in which I can keep that in check and that don't require medication. And so that's what I've been really trying to do.
What non-medical ways have you found that do work for diminishing anxiety?
Some of them are really obvious and practical, like exercise. I'm a bit lazy, but I know that it makes a difference, particularly for me swimming. So I don't know whether it's the sensuality of the water as well as the exercise, but that helps a great deal. probably the most profound factor, I think, is in actually surrendering to the idea of a higher narrative, that if you can reconstruct the meaning of your life according to ideas of fate and of God and of faith, even though to me that's still somewhat alien because I'm from such a secular childhood and background, but I am beginning to recognize that understanding myself in terms of things being meant to happen the way they happen or not helps me. It helps me a lot.
Of course, we live in such a secular age, that kind of faith is perhaps harder for people to come by today than it used to be.
I think it is, and I actually think it's a shame. And when I listen to Richard Dawkins and Hitchens, I don't feel like they're doing us a favor. I really don't. There's so much research on the positive mental health effects of faith, on the positive physical health effects of faith. So to just attack it purely on the grounds that we have problems with doctrine and fundamentalist ideology is a shame in a way, because I think many of us could benefit from it.
Mm. You have a lovely and kind of intriguing passage near the end of the book when you write a bit about a church you go to. Actually, I was going to ask if you could read a bit from that section.
Sure. There is a church down the street from my house, a pretty little church with a diminutive congregation struggling to stay afloat in our culturally mixed downtown neighborhood. The priest wafts too much incense about and makes too many baffling references to the parable of Job and the fig tree. I come home and practice the language, announcing to my husband Ambrose, "And lo, I checked the phone messages that you hath not checked since Friday, and behold, you hath a message from the marketing director at A&P Groceries that you musteth return, for they are on deadline, and you hath not completed your cheese label task." I relish the idiocy, and I'm fully prepared to get used to it, for I have been idiotic all my life, an utter fool, believing that the man I loved and lived with would honor me, expecting my employers to cherish my work, hoping that highlighting violence would make it comprehensible rather than toxic, fearing cows and bills. How is any of that, any of our present secular experience in this time of profound social transition, less intrinsically foolish than praying ritually, as one does in the church or the temple or mosque, for the health of one's family and friends, for the community and the nation and the planet? I offer a modern update on Pascal's wager. In the late 17th century, the French scientist Blaise Pascal, lamenting that greater faith could be placed in reason if reason were only reasonable, encouraged his colleagues and friends to make a bet. "Wager," he said, "that there is a God, for what have you got to lose if there isn't?" My version is somewhat different. Dare to be irrational, because guess what? You already are. And wager that your life has a purpose, a meaning, an overarching story. And imagine within yourself a light or spark or Lord that will show you the way.